and welcome once again to Crazy Comics and Stories. It's me, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rat Bastard. And at the other end of the series of tubes and wires that we call the internets is Joe, Crazy Writer. How you doing today, Joe?
This show is not a substitution for actual human contact, no matter what its host says.
I had human contact recently.
Oh, well, wait, is this another incident?
No.
Oh, okay, then we can talk about it.
The boy got married.
Da, 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 da. Wait, that's a Newlywed Game, isn't it? I don't know.
Yes.
Oh, we should have Eubanks.
And I officiated.
What is the strangest place you've ever made whoopee? Oh, in the butt.
That'd be the butt, Bob.
The butt, Bob.
For years and years, he denied that clip existed. But on the Game Show Network, they had this big countdown on New Year's Eve 1999, hosted by the Unknown Comic. And they found...
Sorry, I was trying to give some background music.
They found the clip and showed it. And at midnight, the Unknown Comic removed the bag.
And everybody screamed and said, put it back on!
Yeah, they pretty much would like, oh, okay.
Actually, I think I was singing Mean Gene, the Dancing Machine.
Probably.
But enough about that. What the world demands to know. Did you hold up your giant-sized man thing at the boys' officiation?
No, I didn't bring a book. I decided that the giant-sized man thing joke was just a little much. But I did get some stuff in there, such as the one that I'm proudest of is, do you, Michaela, take the boy to be your lawfully wedded husband? Let's see. Now,
I happen to know before we started the show, Corey said nobody got any of this on video.
Yeah.
That would be a sound clip for the age. That could get you viral fame on the YouTubes. But anyways.
But, you know, there is the picture of me officiating, wearing part of the clothing of the best dressed man in comics.
Did you offer jeans? I opted
for jeans because it was 90 goddamn degrees out.
Oh, you know, Denver is gone nuts. They were like 3 days ago, as we're recording this, it was like 101 degrees. And even as we speak, they got like a snow warning. They're going to get like 6 inches of snow.
Yeah.
I mean, Minnesota, we went from, like you said, 90 degrees to
50.
Well, we had some 70s, which were nice. And then it went to 50 overnight, and it has yet to recover.
It's funny how, you know, 2 days ago, I'm doing the wedding, and we're all like, it's so hot. We did it in the library where Michaela, Mike's bride, works. And it was a really nice setting. At the end caps, they had pictures of them as kids and some of the engagement pictures and their favorite books when they were children. You know, so here were, you know, picture books, and here were books they read in grade school, and here were books that they read in junior high and books that they're reading now. And I thought that was very, very cool.
Any graphic novels?
No, but Mike's thing for the stuff he's reading now, all Warhammer books. So he's really excited about the Warhammer comic and was like drilling me for information about, you know, well, the guy who's writing is a big Warhammer fan. No, but he wrote the Star Wars comic and he writes this and he writes this. And, you know, he's talked about how he had to actually go to the GDW office and, you know, take classes on Warhammer, et cetera, et cetera. The other fun things that I put in the ceremony were, you know, when you do the I now present to you and the groom and bride, It was, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, I proudly present to you for the first time ever, Mr. Michael and Mrs. Michaela Strode!
Whoa, 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 stop, stop, stop. We don't have 10 grand in the budget to pay off, what's his name? So, yeah, that never happened. Never happened. Nope, nope, nope.
No, I was doing the Road Dog.
Oh, okay. Then finish it. You were in the middle of it. Oh.
Oh, no, that's how it ends.
Oh, I thought, wait, I didn't hear the D. Never mind. Leave them hanging. Leave them wanting more.
But no, it was a really nice ceremony. And one thing that really, there were two things that kind of, as a dad, kind of made me, you know, kind of tear up inside. First is they gave me this letter where they wanted me to come over at like 11 o'clock. And the wedding wasn't until 4. And I was thinking, it must be that they want to do a rehearsal and all this other stuff. And I got there and they were like, oh, do you want some waffles? We're just making breakfast. And they just kind of had me there. And when Mike went to get dressed, she said, we had you here because we're both really, really nervous. And we thought that, you know, just chatting with you for the day would make things go pretty smooth. And then when the boy read his vows, he was crying through the vows.
Outstanding.
So I put my hand on his shoulder to help him get through.
Gave him a good beat down. Come on, man up.
Well, that was after.
See why I wasn't invited to the wedding.
But no, afterward we put him through a table. But that's different.
Yeah, now you're talking. Yeah, okay.
But nope, that's what I did this weekend. Usually Joe has a story about all the stuff he's done, but I actually went out and did something among people. And there were a total of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 other people there. And it's funny, before we went, my son was militant. I am going to be standing by the door, and if anybody shows up, we have masks. And if they don't put on a mask, I will tell them to leave, and they cannot come in. And all I can think is, it's 5 people, dude. It's your parents, her parents, your brother, and your brother's girlfriend, and the photographers. Don't worry about it.
Wait, how many kids did you have?
I have one.
Oh, okay. So
he has a half-brother.
Okay, okay. I thought here I thought we'd find something brand new and exciting about Mr. Strode. He was a traveling salesman for a while.
Well, you know all those jokes about the farmer's daughter?
Uh-oh.
That was me.
Hey, watch it. My cousin was the farmer's daughter.
So was I. That's why I said the jokes were about me.
For some of the people that, you know, as religious as she is, I can't believe she told me those things. Scarred me for life.
But that's not why we're here.
Amy, want to move to Alabama? What? I'm sorry, what?
That's not why we're here.
No, it isn't.
We're here to talk about the draft.
Oh, yeah. Ooh, let me turn the fan off.
Yeah, you had to have the heat on this morning because I woke up and the house was chilly. And I thought, I don't mind it being chilly. Then after I've been working for an hour, it's like my hands are starting to get cold. And I went to the thermometer, and it's like in the house it was 58 degrees. Outside it was like 42. And it's like, nope, the heat's going on. I don't care.
We had the house. It was nice and toasty. We had it wide open. And I told Chris, much to her chagrin, that when I went to bed that night, and they were talking, I think it went Sunday to Monday is when it went bad. It was like 70, went down to 52, and it has yet to get above 60.
No, Sunday it was, that was the wedding, and I think.
Oh, did it get hot? Really?
Sunday, well, down in St. Peter, it got up to 90.
I'll tell you why.
Oh, God, I'm dying.
When we get to, I'll either put it in reviews or geeking. I'll explain what I just did on my day off. It's coming up. But yeah, the temp went down, and then I told Chris when we went to bed, I'm going to close the windows and keep the heat in the house, because otherwise, we'll put the heat on too, which isn't a bad time this time of year, because you can test it, and of course, if it doesn't work, get it fixed.
Yeah, you've got time to get it fixed.
You can have the windows open if you got forced air, and plus there's less of a chance of carbon monoxide death because something's effed up in your furnace. So, but the problem I have is that Chris is at that age where women tend to feel extremely hot. So for her, she would like it to be 50 degrees in the house so she can actually be comfortable. Me, I don't mind it when I'm sleeping, but when I get up to run to the bathroom, ooh, air shrinkage, terrible, terrible.
Well, I don't mind it if I'm, you know, for waking up and getting ready, but man, sitting at the desk, after a while, it's like, yeah, this is just too cold.
Yeah.
I'm still at the desk. Still.
Still.
Still at
the desk. Yep. See, Corey, he goes to work, he eats, he pods, all for you. Because he is, and this podcast is,
a national treasure.
Yes.
Not only that, Saturday was an AEW pay-per-view, which we will talk about later on. But, no, we haven't done this in a little while.
Nope.
We read some comics and going to tell you about them.
We did.
Going to tell you all about them.
First one I read about is a book I got off the eBays called Kong on the Planet of the Apes. Somehow, I ended up with issue number one. And it was intriguing enough where I figured it, and it's been long enough since the book has actually come out, that I would dig up an actual copy of it. And I was able to find a cheap copy on the eBays. According to AtomicAvenue.com, this was published by Boom Studios, 2017-2018. Comes with a variety of variant covers. So if you're paying a lot for it, it might be a variant cover. There's a few by Jay Lee, which might be kind of cool to see. I found a Loot Crate book, if you remember. Yeah. And it was fairly cheap.
I remember when Loot Crate was a thing.
Oh, yeah. So basically, following the events of the original Planet of the Apes, the 1968 film, Dr. Zaius and General Ursus, I think that's right, Ursus. It's been a long time since I've seen the film. And he was in the second one, not the first. They lead a small band of soldiers into the Forbidden Zone to destroy any remaining evidence of Taylor's time amongst them. Apparently, Taylor, in this, there's a bit of a civil war brewing from people who saw Taylor and people didn't see him. And but to the apes' surprise, they discover a Kong. Now they must venture to Skull Island with Cornelius and Zira to discover the truth. They may not survive the deadliest journey of their lives. Well, obviously they did because they're in beneath the Planet of the Apes. I love Planet of the Apes stuff. I have geeked on Planet of the Apes stuff in the past. So after reading that first issue, I was actually kind of excited about it. The art is really well. I do have a problem with it because a lot of times I can't tell the difference between Cornelius, Zira, or Milo, some of the other characters. You can always tell the General Ursus because he's always got that big goofy hat. Respect the hat, boy! And Dr. Zaius, of course, is the only orangutan along with him. The story is a lot of fun. They go off the idea that, basically they find the Kong behind the Statue of Liberty, which they were all planning to blow up, and I don't know if they ever got around to doing that. If you like the Kongs, actually, I would say if you like Planet of the Apes more than anything, you will probably enjoy reading this. It was a fun little series. Writer Ryan Ferrier, and artist by Carlos Mengel, who also did Kong of Skull Island, as well as other Planet of the Apes. And it's a fantastic meeting of franchises. I found it compelling. I found it a lot of fun for both to put them together. They do a good job of setting things up for Beneath the Planet of the Apes. And they also do a little explanation about how they actually found Taylor's ship, which, if you remember in the original, sunk deep. So, obviously, on the scale we use,
buy, borrow, ignore.
I bought it. If you're intrigued by the franchise but not totally in love with it, you could definitely borrow it. But this is a good piece cross-franchising work. And like I said, you should be able to find issues. They're not terribly expensive. I found the Loot Crate volume on the eBays for about $8. So you could probably do that and, you know, maybe find it cheap somewhere else as well. Mr. Strode?
The first book that I want to review is Inkblot from Image. We talked about this when it was in previews. It is a fantasy series by Emma Kubert and Rusty Glad. They are collaborating with Emma Kubert, kind of doing the plot and the penciling, and Rusty Glad doing the scripting and inking. And they're listed as, it's not listed as written by, drawn by, whatever. It's just Emma Kubert and Rusty Glad. And yes, Emma Kubert is Joe Kubert's granddaughter. It is a fantasy book. The first few pages set up the world and universe that they're playing in. It's a family that each one is in charge of a different realm. And if you've read fantasy books, especially, what was that book? The one by David Eddings. He did a 5-book series, and he had a map in the front. And after reading, like, the first half of the first book, I went, oh, so basically this map is everything's listed in the map is a place they're going to go and have an adventure. Okay. Not like the Conan books where, okay, here's a map, and he might go to some lands, and he might not go to others. And even Lord of the Rings, you know, they have this huge map. They don't go everywhere on it. But in the setup for this, it's very clear that we're going to go everywhere. Our lead character is a woman who she works in the library, and it's her job to write up spells. Well, she messes one up, creates a vortex, and out of that vortex comes a cat. And it's not a talking cat. It's not like Lion Cat in Saga. It's not. Nope, it's just a cat. However, it's able to open portals to the other realms. So in the first issue, the cat opens a portal to the realm of giants, where her sister has gone, and we get some background on what's going on there, and they barely escape death by getting back to the library in time. The art by Emma Kubert is wonderful. Fits the fantasy idea very well. It also has something that I miss in a lot of comics. Light colors. Blue skies. It's not all nighttime and dark and purple and black and blue. And no, there were light colors and people had, there was sunlight. And if you think I'm exaggerating, I sat down and read some DC books, and I swear to Koresh that every single one of the books was set at night. And the Batman books weren't only set at night, they were set at night, and it looked like they were in a dark cave. So I really appreciated the lighter color palette, the fact that because the colors were so light, you could actually see the art. And my only issue is that the first issue is all set up, and it's told in such a way that it goes really fast. You know, there's a big info dump in the first 5 pages, and then after that we get into the story, and the story moves really fast. And it's unbelievably clear that this is paced for a graphic novel, not an individual comic. So for individual issues, I will rate it as a borrow, but when it is collected, I will rate it as a buy. And I like the fact that Image is really diving into fantasy comics and crime comics, and they're doing genres outside of superheroes. Fantasy is one of those genres that I wish comics would have done ages ago when Conan took off. They could have done so much more, especially in the 80s when Dungeons & Dragons was huge. But now we've got Inkblot. It's a fun book, and it reads like kind of those fantasy novels that come out. It's not, you know, really dark. It's not, you know, It's not what is the show? The Game of Thrones. It's more The Hobbit. So it's a borrow as a regular comic, but it'll be a buy as a trade paperback. Joe?
Next one on my list is Headlocked, the pro wrestling series by Michael Kingston, with art by all sorts of people, as well as bonus stories by, I don't know, you probably never heard of him. Let's see, Jerry the King Lawler. Yeah, Samoa King. Let's see, I think Scott Loss. Yeah, you haven't heard of these. That just never lasts. I luck out. Headlocked was originally a comic book, and I actually have them all, but it was just a really, really small press one that probably nobody's heard of. So Michael did the next best thing and went to the Kickstarter. And what he did is he solicited 4 volumes, with the 5th one still coming. And it took him forever because he had people doing artwork. He had people doing stories. And, you know, I got it in the mail. I got the swag. It had been sitting on my book step. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to bring these to work. I'm going to try reading them. Oh, my God. It's fucking brilliant. I should have guessed, because in the beginning, Michael talks about in 1978, his first comic book bought off the newsstand by his mom was Amazing Spider-Man 187. Mine, of course, was 178. In 85, he saw George the Animal steal, eating turnbuckles, running wild on the first Saturday night's main event, and he's loved wrestling ever since. Me, I'm an old, old AWA fan, and I think the first one I watched was it was a arena match, which I didn't realize at the time. And it was Mad Dog Vachon, the Crusher, versus Big John Studd and Jerry, the Crusher, Blackwell. And basically, Mad Dog got squashed and out on a cart. And I was like, what the hell is this? You know. And the story goes along with a character, Mike Hartman. And he starts off at a sophomore at a junior college. He's doing art. And he explains how he's always loved pro wrestling, because pro wrestling to him is kind of ballet, it's art in motion. So he goes off to try to realize his dream. Corey, you've heard the story of how Hulk Hogan got into pro wrestling?
I've heard his version of it.
Yeah, he allegedly goes to a gym, and the guy said, yeah, we'll show you what to do, and they proceeded to break his leg. When he healed up, he went back to the gym, and the guys were kind of like, huh, there must be something here. Well, this is kind of almost a similar baptism of fire, where he goes and he pays $400 to go to a gym, and he has to go through just hell to try to get the workout, like 400 squats, 400 push-ups, run around the gym. Then he has to beat one of the pro wrestlers, which he ends up doing, and then he's got to go against the guy who runs the gym, and there's no way he's going to beat this guy, especially not after getting the shit beat out of him. So he does what anybody does. He basically punches the guy in his nuts, which gets him to freak out, and he gets tackled, and the guys are, come on, you old pussy, I'll tear your goddamn eyes out. Who the fuck do you think you are? Don't come to my ring embarrassing. He gets booted out. So he doesn't get anywhere in his first try to break into pro wrestling. There's not the romantic intrigue, but you wonder who Mike talked to, because this strikes me as so authentic in terms of how Mike ends up, Mike the writer versus Mike the fictional character, as he gets into pro wrestling. And there is a big, big incident, which allow me to take a quick browse at. Okay. Yeah, at the end of one, you see Mike just bloodied to hell, with a gash across his face, and it's coming down, and there's a reporter who's got the mat on for the Vince McMahon character in the book, who runs all the Wrestling Federation, and wants to find this guy, Mike Hartman. Well, Mike's pretty much person non grata in pro wrestling, because he had, I guess Corey and I would call it a New Jack incident, where a guy told New Jack, who was a pretty rough pro wrestler in ECW to blade him. Well, he did. He cut him so deep, and then this guy ends up suing my New Jack, and it's you can look it up. You can Google it and hear, see online.
It's called the Mass Transit Lawsuit. And so, it's a fascinating story, man.
Well, this is kind of alluded to that, but we really don't know what the hell happened to Mike. And in the first book, of course, there's, I already mentioned Samoa Joe, Young Bucks, MVP, did the extra stories, the bonus stories at the end. There's even one in one of them with by Ric Flair. None of the characters are name characters, but if you watch and you know pro wrestling, you can kind of figure out who they are. Don't need to know that in order to enjoy the book. In the second book, of course, you know, being a person non grata, how does he get into pro wrestling and start to make his name? Who's the one who takes him under his wing to get him going? And I got to tell you, in a course of a day, I read all four volumes that are out now, and it was just. And what killed me is I was thinking, oh, four volumes, we're at the end. No, we're not. We're waiting for the fifth volume, which he's published on his. Well, he's done the Kickstarter, but he's working to try to get it done. Every cover has beautiful art by Jerry the King Lawler. Every book through the Kickstarter was autographed by the King and Michael as well. Now, I've said it's from Kickstarter, and you're like, well, how am I going to get a hold of copies of this? Well, it's easy. www.headlockedcomic.com. You can go to the Facebook, Headlock Comic. You can go to the Twitter. You can go to the Instagram, same thing. Google Michael Kingston. He's on Facebook as well. And it all links to the site. You can go there. Not only get the books, and as I said, there's four right now. A Single Step, The Last Territory, Volume 1, Volume 2, and The Hard Way. The fifth one isn't out yet. It's still, I don't know if you can jump on a Kickstarter once it's done, but give Mike a call or a quick give me an email. I'm sure he'll love to get you on the list to get a copy. Just an amazing story. If you love pro wrestling, you owe it to yourself to go find these. If you like a good story, a good coming of age, you want to peer behind the curtain of what pro wrestling is probably like. And I'm no doubt Mike's gotten all these stories from real pro wrestlers, because as we talked about the New Jack incident, and I mentioned a little bit about the Hulk Hogan thing, and you know he's taking a combination of all this and giving it his own spin and making it a fictional story. Even the Ric Flair story was really touching, because they had it's obviously Ric Flair's attitude towards seeing his daughter wrestle. And again, they can't say it's Ric Flair, but hey, when you were, you can't deny who the man is. You know what I'm saying? For me to like, just like I said, blow through all four of these in an afternoon, in a way I kind of kicked myself, because I just was so compelled to read it. And then when I got to the end, I was like, fortunately I was smart enough to order the fifth one online, and I have no idea how long Mike's going to keep this story going, but it's obvious he loves comics, he knows wrestling, and he has given this the best treatment I think he can. And the art is by Valentin Gorman Riviera. It's excellent art. You can always tell who's who. And of course, it leaves on a cliffhanger. Mike, you're killing me here. So check it out, Mr. Strode.
Marvel had a big summer crossover that got interrupted and rescheduled and all messed up by the COVID-19. But the final issue has come out, and that is Empire.
And?
Empire is by Dan Slott, Al Ewing, and the artist Valerio Schitti, which is the most ironic name ever, because his art is about as far from shitty as you can get. Thank you. Thank you. Everybody. You've been a beautiful crowd. I'll be here all week. This is another alien invasion story. I think Earth has been invaded by aliens about more times than I've had a peanut butter sandwich in the Marvel Universe. But the The plot is that years and years and years ago, I think in Marvel time, it's like, I don't know, 5 years. The Celestial Madonna gave birth to the Kwatai, which is a plant-based race's child who will be the Celestial Messiah. So if you want all the background, you would read the Celestial Madonna story that Steve Englehart had weaving through his stuff in the 70s. And then when he came back, he touched on it in his Silver Surfer run in the late 80s.
Now, there was a Zero issue. Does the Zero issue reprint that?
No, the Zero issue sets everything up.
Well, how about there's a handbook, too?
Yes, the handbook does that.
Okay.
They reference a lot of it, so you get a lot of the background. But where we are now is that this Kwatai, who is he's actually shown up in a few other books. He is ascending to his rightful spot. The Kree and the Skrulls have forged a partnership. They have put aside their war. And we find out that there is a secret in their past, and the secret is that they tried to destroy this race and failed. And now the big twist in the first issue is that the plant race has decided they're going to wipe out the Kree and the Skrulls, and if Earth gets in the way, well, that's, you know, tough shit. So you've got the Fantastic Four and the Avengers dealing with the fact that the Kree and the Skrull are coming here to fight this war with the Kwatai. It also has some of the characters from Young Avengers, because Hulkling, who was part Kree and part Skrull, is the current leader of the two races. So you've got all of this Marvel intrigue. They've basically gone through and grabbed some plot threads that were just floating out there and nobody was using and tied it up. Now, with a big event book, you're going to get a lot of crossovers and you've got a lot of big event scenes and everything. But the big question in it is it worth it? If you're looking for something that changes fundamentally, you know, something in the Marvel Universe, no, it doesn't. If you're looking for something with a lot of spectacle and a good reason for the tie-ins, then yes, it works as an event story. I actually just sat and read the 7 issues, the Zero issue and the 6 of the regular book, and I would have put it as a borrow except for Valerio Schitti's art, which is beautiful. He makes it feel like a big deal. He's able to draw huge crowd scenes and big fight scenes in lots of different areas. You've got space stuff. You've got stuff on the blue area of the moon. You've got stuff in the U.S. You've got stuff on the Kree home world. You've got stuff on the Skrull home world. You've got stuff in the Savage Land. You've got stuff on Krakoa, because Krakoa is a plant, and the Kwatai are able to control plants, and on and on and on. My only real issue is that we get to the last issue, and the resolution has some hand-waving in it. Like, oh, here's this thing that we did that solved the entire problem. So they've got like 3 issues that come after that are epilogues that may kind of work on that a little bit. But it really felt like it's a whole bunch of buildup and then ta-da, solved. Which story-wise didn't quite click for me. But any sins in the story are overwhelmed by just how beautiful this art is. And the sins in the story I can forgive, because, you know, it's big event. Big events have these things in them where I think because it happened, if it wouldn't have been for publishing shutting down in April and May, they might have changed some things. It might have had a different impact. But once it sat down in a single book, it's going to be an okay read. It's not a big universe-changing event. It is a good Fantastic Four story. It is a good Avengers story. If you're somebody like me who's been reading about all this cosmic stuff forever and ever and ever, there's these, you know, Dan Slott knows his stuff. So he's able to pull all of this Marvel continuity detail into it. But it doesn't overwhelm the story. It adds to the story. So as I said, as an event, I give it a buy. And the art carries it that extra step. But if you're not somebody who's going to be blown away by the art, you might just want to borrow. You know, when it comes to the library or it's on Marvel Unlimited, read it there. But for me, the art was good enough that I want it on my shelf. Joe, what's your next book?
I pulled a couple off the shelf that I haven't read or maybe I've reread. The first one was Marvel What If, The Complete Collection, Volume 1. And
that was my favorite of the entire run, to be honest.
I think we're going to do something a little different here, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to give the story, because basically this is stuff from Roy Thomas, Herb Trimpe, Jim Shooter, Gil Kane, Frank Robbins, Roy Thomas, just a who's who of Marvel. And nowadays it's not as special, because we've seen multiverses and things change and all that stuff. But I can't tell you how big it was, especially for that number one. What If Spider-Man Joined the Fantastic Four? It was published February 77. I started probably later that year with the Spider-Man that I always talk about. So for me to read that, I was like, oh, this was like one of my holy grails. I hunted high and low for it. I don't know what I paid for it. $20 comes to mind, even though Guide right now has it around 26 for near mint, although, you know, you can probably find it for more or for less. This whole volume was $39.99, and of course, you know, you could probably find it for less. But just, it was just so much fun, because I knew the first time Spider-Man met the Fantastic Four, he tried to join and he left. What they did is, how do you say the name of the Watcher?
Uatu.
Uatu. The big change was when Spider-Man tried to take off the first time after being rejected by the Fantastic Four, Sue goes, "Spider-Man, wait." He didn't. But in this universe, something within Peter Parker responds and he comes back. This has 12 issues. One of the fun things is they reprint the letter page, and of course, all the next issue, Conan Walks the Earth, which doesn't occur to issue 13 for whatever reason. But
that was the story where John Buscema's art was over in the Philippines.
Oh no.
And the inker was like, "It's too beautiful."
Oh, and when it came out, it's definitely worth picking up. It's not in this issue though, but I'm going to say the What If titles, and then Corey, if you remember them, and I'm pretty sure.
Oh, I do. Let me know. I've actually read them all within the last year or so.
Oh, and that's perfect. Okay. So obviously the first one was What If Spider-Man Had Joined the Fantastic Four, which for me, again, that was a holy grail. When I finally read it, it was utterly amazing, and it was also kind of sad at the end, because at the end Reed loses Sue to the Submariner. And of course, if you know what I'm talking about, you're obviously a Marvel geek like me. What did you think of this one, Corey?
When I was a kid, it introduced me. Marvel had already introduced me to the multiverse, but this was such a cool concept that, especially that they went to, all right, in this issue at this precise point, this happens instead of this. Going back and reading it now, it's still a very fun book. I'm kind of surprised that What If lasted as long as it did, because you really needed to know a lot of what was going on at Marvel. Roy Thomas overwrites. It's what he does. So I could see a modern reader kind of going, oh my God, it's too many words. But if you're able to get through Roy Thomas's prose, it's a really good story.
issue two was, what if the Hulk had always had Bruce Banner's brain? And, again, it's happened. But at the time, Hulk was still the mindless brute running around.
Or the child Hulk.
Yeah, the child Hulk. And in this one, I'm just paging through it quick. You got to read it. I mean, there's Galactus. We see Xavier in there. There's an allusion to the failed beginning of the Avengers, because remember how the Avengers was formed. Loki puts a piece of dynamite illusion on the tracks. Hulk comes down and smashes through the tracks. Well, when he has Bruce Banner's mind, he gently lands. He reaches out like a normal man does, and when it disappears, Loki's thwarted and goes away. So Marvel Universe is really changed in a way. Again, this one was written by Roy Thomas with Herb Trimpart, which is always a treat. What did you think of it, Mr. Strode?
I liked it. I didn't like it as much as number one, but I did like it. And again, I like the fact that they reference specific points in Marvel history that, okay, because of this, this happened. Because of this, this happened. And to me, that's a lot of what makes What If fun.
Next one is number three. What if the Avengers had never been? I should have had these marked better, but I think the crux of the matter is they just go apart, and it's just Iron Man who eventually has a showdown with the Hulk and Submariner. And this one was done by Jim Shooter, Gil Kane co-plotting it with art by Gil Kane. So that alone's worth picking it up.
However, I didn't care for this story. Because it kind of Iron Man gave... This is the one where Iron Man gave everybody armor. And Gil Kane, while he plotted the story, he really didn't... It wasn't his best work. I remember this is one where I went, I don't care for this one as much. Giving it a letter grade, I would have given it a C.
And for me, it was kind of interesting because I was like, oh, my God, they killed off Iron Man. Yeah, I'm giving a spoiler from something published in June 77. So, again, it was not a happy ending. But this is the first blurb. The next issue, what if Conan the Barbarian walked the earth today? Nope, didn't happen. Instead, we got what if the invaders had stayed together after World War II? And you know it was Roy Thomas and Frank Robbins. Not only co-plotting it, but then Frank doing the art. This is one of those that I just read it, and even now I still can't fathom it. But, you know, they survive into the Cold War, and...
This was also the one, it straightened out the Captain America timeline.
Because yeah.
They dropped in some stuff where this person had been Captain America, et cetera, and they went, okay, after Captain America was frozen, this character took over, and then he was killed, and this character took over, and on and on and on. So it was more straightening out the Marvel continuity, and I believe that the Watcher in this one even said, this one may have actually happened in your universe.
And I believe they sucked it in, didn't they? They used it for that? So, yeah, if some you're a continuity it, guy, yeah, well, you know, it's been, what, 80 years of stuff? So why not?
I love this issue. This was, out of the first six issues, this was my favorite.
This one, I don't know. I guess I wasn't really a big Captain America fan then. But then, of course, number five, what if Captain America hadn't vanished during World War II? And this was written by Don Glut, with George Tuska as artist. So,
this was another C. Don Glut is, he's an okay writer, but the only Marvel stuff he did was either writing over Roy Thomas's plots or some What If stuff. And I always found his dialogue really cringy.
But Bucky lives. And again, now we know he did anyway. So, okay. Let's see. Number five was, what if Captain America? No, I just did that one. Issue six. What if the Fantastic Four had different superpowers?
This one was just goofy.
Yeah, it was. I mean, Mr. Fantastic was a big brain. It ended kind of interesting because in a final battle, Mr. Fantastic overtakes Doom's body. So yeah. This is actually a reality that I could see somebody pulling out of their Watusi and running it in current continuity. But, you know, it was kind of like Ben Grimm had wings. Johnny Storm could turn into a big metal man. And Sue Richard had fantastic, Mr. Fantastic stretching power. And Mr. Fantastic was just a big brain.
Yeah, that was interesting. That was the first one where I went, yeah, this is just too goofy. Who wrote that, by the way?
It was written by Roy Thomas with art by Jim Craig and Rick Holberg.
Huh. So. Roy must not have been paying too much attention during that.
Well, time. He might have been more into. Well, he didn't write the next one, but the next one was one that was just kind of like, hey now, what if somebody else had become the Amazing Spider-Man? What if Flash Thompson got spider powers? What if Colonel John Jameson got spider powers? What if Betty Brant? So basically, you take the same radioactive spider, yet somehow these other guys get bit. And they, this was a, what'd you call it? It was a three-parter, sort of.
Well, it was an anthology. It was three short stories, which in one way I liked better because each of them just kind of had a twist. And it was more, okay, what's the twist? Rather than kind of gaming it out to see how far it would go.
And then at the end was something that always stuck with my brain. And it says, the Watcher says, well, basically, because in each of these realities, Peter Parker kept the spider. And by watching it, he used the last of the spider's venom, made a serum, and became your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. And so says the Watcher, you see, then that was Destiny's plan for Peter Parker to become the Amazing Spider-Man. So that always stuck with me. It's like no matter what reality you're in, Parker is supposed to be Spider-Man. The other fun thing in this issue, it's on page 254 or on the letter page, if you have the actual comic, people giving all sorts of what ifs.
Yeah.
Some of them, what if Gwen Stacy hadn't died, which is not in this book, but is a fantastic story to look up by Tony Isabella. What if Magneto, not Professor X, had gathered the five young mutants? Anyways, you can read it. Corey, what was your take on this this threesome of other Spider-Men?
They were okay. They weren't long enough to, like I said, they weren't long enough to game it out much. But I thought that it was an interesting way to use the book. Because remember, What If was double-sized. The first run was always double-sized. So they had a lot of pages to fill. And what about you?
Well, I was a Spider-Man fan, so this one... This might have been the first one I read, and then I saw that, you know, the number one was like, oh, my God. And if you remember, I knew all these early Spider-Men because I read those paperbacks that had come out with early reprints. So I was lucked out where I actually knew what the heck was going on. This was fun just because they took a little bit of the continuity. How did Flash get the spider powers? Well, he pushed Peter Parker aside after going to the exhibit anyways. Anyways, it's a lot of fun to read. The next one is one to this day I still don't get. At number 8, what if the world knew Daredevil is blind? Don Glut, Scott Shaw, who cares? He still's got the same powers he had if he wasn't blind. It's just not as big a twist. The story was interesting. The Watcher looked like a pissed off kingpin. Because of the art of Alan Kupenberger and Jim Mooney. But it was just, it's an interesting story. I didn't know enough about Daredevil. I still don't about those early issues. And believe me, I've tried reading them through my Marvel Essentials. But it's kind of like, who cares? He's not blind. He's still Daredevil. In the book, he doesn't stay Daredevil, but... Anyways, maybe, I don't know, Corey, you're a little more versed in Daredevil than me. What's your take on this one?
I thought this one was kind of a stretch. And it was weird because I remember when it came out and reading it and going, wow, they're already running out of ideas. That's odd.
Yeah, considering the issue before, they got about 100 ideas already. And, of course, this one also has a who wrote it? Scott Shaw. What if the spider had been bitten by a radioactive human?
Yeah, that was funny.
It's as goofy as you think it is. The next one, I believe, is continuity. What if the Avengers had fought evil during the 1950s with Marvel Boy, 3D Man, Venus, Gorilla Man, and the Human Robot?
I adored this comic so much.
Yep.
I this was one where... good thing I don't collect to sell them later, because I remember I read this one so much that after a while it was like, oh, the covers started to come off. God damn it. Using these obscure 50s characters, tying in with the Yellow Claw series, and then it was brought back as Agents of Atlas in the 2000s. This was just a fantastic book. Just a fantastic issue. Loved it. A lot of fun.
And like I said, it's one of the few that is considered continuity. And what I love is when they're like, I just was looking like when Venus shows up and a little, see Venus's own magazine during the 1950s. Oh, okay. I guess I'll go and do that. Which, I don't know. Can you do that on Marvel Unlimited? Do they put them online?
I think they're there.
There you go. We can do it now. Number 10. What if Jane Foster had found the Hammer of Thor? Oddly enough, this one's a little pricey right now. I wonder why. Allegedly around $30 going upwards. So, again, it's something we've seen. But back then, this was kind of like, oh, my God, this is crazy. This is a minor geeking or freaking, too, because this is one of the things I hate in my trade paperbacks. I've got a page in this that's ripped. So I'm kind of like, son of a bean. But again, I wasn't a big Thor guy. I didn't quite know what was going on, but I knew enough to realize just how big it was that she became Thor. I enjoyed it. It was a good story. Don Glut again, Rick Holberg doing the art. Corey, what's your take on this amazingly expensive comic?
I thought it was okay. It stuck to the real early part of Thor, where, let's be honest, man, the real early Thor stories are god-awful. It's no coincidence that both Kirby and Stan Lee left Thor pretty quickly, and then all of a sudden came back. It's like, oh, crap, it's not selling. We better get back on this book.
Yeah.
So it's... okay, is it worth the $30 or whatever? No, because it's not part of the actual female Thor story. But I thought it was okay. It wasn't, and it was such a letdown after number 9 being so cool. And then that one was just, okay. That's it was average, I think is the best way to put it.
And what was fun on this one is on the letter page, they have an ad in the bottom. And now... the Beatles! Don't miss Marvel Super Special number 4! And believe me, I didn't. Speaking of books, I read till they fell apart.
Oh, yeah, same here. George Perez drawing the Beatles, man.
Oh, I did pick up a good copy, so I do have a good one as well. Now let's jump to number 11. From writer, artist, and editor Jack Kirby. Inked by Mike Royer and Bill Ray. Colored by Carl Gafford. And with edited by Rascally Roy Thomas. What if the original Marvel bullpen had become the Fantastic Four?
This was a very fun story.
It was.
And some of the stories behind the scenes are even more fun.
Yeah. And I believe you can go to an issue, a back issue from Tomorrow Press to get that. So, yeah, this was kind of fun. I mean, this is one of those issues I had. And in the back of my brain, when I was a kid, I wanted to get all these people's autographs. I mean, we're talking... oh, I'm trying to figure out who they got. Who is it?
All right, it's Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, Sol Brodsky, and Flo Steinberg.
Yeah. So
And you haven't lived till you've read Jack Kirby writing Stan Lee dialogue.
Oh, yeah, this is a lot of fun. And the last
now,
one is...
Now, Sol Brodsky was supposed to be Roy Thomas.
Oh?
Yep, that's when Roy pitched it to Jack. It was, okay, it's going to be, you know, you and Stan and Flo and me. And Roy didn't want to put Roy in there because Roy came later after Jack wasn't coming into the office anymore. He wanted Sol Brodsky because when Marvel first started, that was, it was Stan, Sol, let's see, Stan was the editor, writer who was in the office 3 days a week. Flo was the receptionist and Sol Brodsky was the production guy. They were the only three in the office.
I'm so, just reading in the letter page. It said, you'll notice an important milestone in Marvel history. Namely, for the first time in some 8 years, Jack Kirby returns to drawing Marvel's first super team, if only for the space of a single and rather offbeat issue. It's the first time Jack has written an FF story as well.
Yep, although that's not true.
Yeah, that just...
There were early issues where... I forget where it was, but there was an early issue where Stan was listed as when it was, you know, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, but Jack actually wrote most of the dialogue because Stan was too busy. But I don't remember what issue it was. I know it was within like the first 12.
And let's see the prices on that one. Yeah, they're all average. Okay. The last one that's reprinted in this tome is What If Rick Jones Had Become the Hulk? Yes. We saw it happen, but in this reality, we remember Childlike Hulk, and what happens here is Rick Jones throws Bruce Banner in the pit because he understands at the last minute before the bomb goes off. Rick's like, the bomb, but at the fateful, crucial and fateful moment, he throws in Banner, and then boom, he gets nailed. And the only real thing with this is that when he turns into Hulk, he's like, ah, quit gawking at me. Get off my back unless you want to rumble. So he's basically a hipster talking mini Hulk.
Yes.
Square is too chicken to fight. Don't need Square's help. So let's see. The credits for this one is Don Glut again and Sal Buscema's art.
I liked it. It was fun. You know, it was kind of average. I did like the Hulk as the angry. I did like the Hulk as kind of the angry brute rather than the misunderstood child.
Yeah. And it ends. It ends more happily, which is kind of fun.
Which is weird for a what if story.
Yeah. And my complaint a lot of times
became everybody dies.
Yeah. And that was kind of part of my complaint with What If later on is because everything was everybody dies. See how much better the reality was. And you're kind of like, nah, it doesn't have to be that way. And there was even one in, I think it was What If number 5, if I believe so, where What If Hulk or Captain America had lived, where Nick Fury randomly dies. And people went apeshit because they're like, oh, why did he die in this? It doesn't make any sense. It's like, it was just one of those random things. You know, they can change history if they want. But they never did that again because it was just too jarring because it didn't have anything to do with the story. The Cap hadn't vanished during World War II, but it ended up with Nick Fury dying. So that's actually explained in the letter pages later on. So, again, a lot of fun. Especially for us old guys who remember the pre-Marvel universe. Now continuity has been so changed, probably half these stories occurred. Well, at least one of them we did. Well, two, three, whatever. Corey, what do you got for your next book?
This would actually have to be the last one because we've gone an hour.
Yeah, we went a lot in that one.
And that is one of the last Black Label DC books. Hellblazer, Rise and Fall by Tommy Taylor and Derek Robinson. I won't even attempt to cover up the fact that I am a huge fan of Derek Robertson's art. He drew The Boys. He drew Transmetropolitan. He's drawn books all over the place. I love his art. It's kind of almost a little more cartoony Neil Adams type thing, where his people look real, but just a little exaggerated. And boy, does it work great on Hellblazer. One of the problems I have, especially with the Vertigo run of Hellblazer, is they would bring in artists who would do very moody, very scratchy art, which, you know, fit what they were trying to do. But having Derek Robertson do his much more realistic art was just wonderful. The story starts with telling us about John Constantine's childhood and shows us more of it than we've seen before. And then it comes to the present, where we see what happened to the two childhood friends in the beginning of the story. Something really bad is happening because people are being impaled. People are nude being impaled on sharp objects on the top of buildings, and they have had angel wings grafted onto them, one of which is a former prime minister. So why is this happening? What's going on? That's what John Constantine will be trying to figure out through the three issues of this series. I also really like the fact that a lot of writers, especially in the DC unit, when Constantine's in the DC universe, don't quite understand the Constantine magic as it was kind of created by Alan Moore and then furthered by Jamie Delano when he ran it. Where it's not, you know, spells and Doctor Strange stuff. No, it's more he messes with reality for the most part. But there are also times when he gets into some real bad occult shit. And this is when he gets into some real bad occult shit. It is a Black Label book, so it is adult. It has a lot of the social satire that Jamie Delano's run had way back in 1988 to like 91. And if you haven't read a John Constantine book in a long time, this is one to pick up. It introduces you to the character, his world, the type of stories he has, without it being a big continuity dump. And, oh man, Derek Robertson's art is so goddamn good. This is a total buy.
Is this a Black Label miniseries?
Yes, it's a Black Label miniseries.
Okay, so it's not part of the regular Constantine. It just got
not at all.
Off the Sandman line. I miss that. Well, give me the name of that one more time.
It is called Hellblazer Rise and Fall. The other thing is, before I would buy it as a trade paperback, I would want to know if they're going to have it at the same dimensions as the comic. Because, you know, the Black Label books are bigger. They're wider and taller so that it shows the art better. And if they're going to go with the regular trade paperback size, I would just go ahead and buy the three issues just so you could get the art at a bigger size so you could see more of the detail. Absolutely a wonderful book. You know who else is absolutely wonderful, Joe?
Hang on. I know the answer. I got it written here somewhere.
It's you for putting up with me for 10 years. But it's also these guys, our sponsors. Believe it or not, kids, this here podcast has sponsors. And that sponsor, since day one, is DreamHost.com. DreamHost.com is the best, bar none, web host in the whole known universe. And if you need a website, head on over to DreamHost.com, put in code CRAZY, that's K-R-A-Y-Z, and get $20 off your first year. Now, if you would like to advertise here on any of the Solitaire Rose Network podcast, you can just email me at solitairerosenetwork@gmail.com, subject advertising. Also, head on over to eBay and look for user Crazy, K-R-A-Y-Z, that's Joe Crazy Writer, who's always telling us about the eBay in every episode of Crazy Comics and Stories. If you would like to contact us, you can do so. You can give us a call at 952-856-0519. Leave a message and we'll play it on the show. Or you can send us an email at solitairerosenetwork@gmail.com. Thanks. I talked about how I covered the AEW event. The pay-per-view was supposed to be. 3 hours.
But
5.5 hours long. Then I had to do an hour and a half audio afterward. So my son is getting married the next day. I'm supposed to be up, dressed, and at his apartment in St. Pete's Peter in by like 11 o'clock.
I'm
going to bed at a little after 2 in the morning. It's like, oh, this is not going to be good. This is not going to be good.
Nope.
But I do it for you people, just like I do these other podcasts. And now we get to Joe's favorite part of the show. No, 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 not where he trains his Alexa to tell him that he gets to poop every day.
I thought we were going to read chick publications.
Well, you could do that if you want, but right now you're going to tell us what's going on the eBays.
Oh, all sorts of stuff. Let's take a quick gander at some of the fun things I've sold. I sold a copy of Words Without Pictures. This is a book from Eclipse, I believe. It was edited by Steve Niles, and it had Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman, John J. Muth, Charles Vess, Stephen R. Bissett, Mark Evanier, John Bolton, as well as an introduction by Matt Fiesel. Words Without Pictures is a collection of prose stories and poems written by comic people we know, and with the exception of the introduction by Matt Fiesel, it reverses the concept of the book by being pictures without words and spot illustrations by John Bolton. Other than that, it's all prose and a fantastic book. You should be able to go find a copy. Don't pay too much for it. They're all over the place. Let's see. Where's my other list of stuff? Oh, did it disappear? Here we go. You were talking about The Boys, which I believe is cranking up. But boy, both The Boys and Lucifer, the last season, are cranking up on television. So I'm going to have some geeking with that when I finally get to it. But I sold a couple variant covers of The Boys' Dear Becky, which is currently being published by Dynamite Comics. I haven't read it. I'm going to probably wait for the book. But it's going pretty good. You should be able to pick up current copies. I believe 4 to date, 5 ready to publish. I think it's a mini series. I'll find out when I read the book. Corey, did you ever watch Primus in the 70s?
I don't even know what it was in the 70s.
It was a popular television series starring Robert Brown as Carter Primus. And it was also a full-color series featuring artwork by Joe Stanton from Carlton. 7 issues. Joe Gill wrote it. Joe Stanton did the art. The ocean's full of mysteries and dangers, and undersea explorer Carl Primus, hence the name, with his vessel Inca and his loyal crew, mean to spend his life investigating them. But there are just as many dangers above the ocean surface in the form of crooked captains determining to kill endangered whales and other evil men interested only in harvesting the sea's vast treasure for their own personal gain. So, TV show, comic book. There, you got it both. In our attempt to list at least once every comic ever published, I'm going to mention I sold my run of Ultra Klutz. It was not a complete run. I kind of got to the point where I just realized I'd probably never get it. So I just sold it off. This was a series started in 86 and ended around 91 by Jeff Nicholson. Unknown to Sam Sog of the planet Klutzoid, the convoluted and arcane machinations of cosmic beings, Marvel's thinly disguised orders of law and chaos, or is it chaos and order? Either way, it caused Sog to be exiled from his solar system and deposited upon in Japan on Earth. Since he's 100 feet tall, Sam decided to become a superhero for the Earthlings. His first attempt at heroism was a little inept, and since Japanese people thought he looked like Ultraman, Ultra Klutz is born. Funny stuff, if you can find it. I also sold, Corey, have you ever seen the movie? Those Magnificent Men in their flying machines. They go uppity up, up. They go down, diddy down, down.
Yes, I have.
I recall it because, as you know, I can sing the theme song. I had the Gold Key movie adaptation issue from 1965. Don't anymore because I sold it. And if you got anything else you're interested in, okay, I have to admit, the last show I talked about this massive 30% sale I was having, and that if you listened to the last episode, you could jump in at the last minute. If you did and found it wasn't running, it's not your fault. I loaded everything up. I cleared out all sorts of stuff, things I've been sitting on for a while.
It's not my fault.
No, eBay didn't run the damn thing. And when I went in this, I mean, everything was loaded the way it should be. Discount 30%, running for a week and a little bit beyond so I could let the podcast people have some fun. It just didn't run, so I canceled it. However, because I love my eBay listeners, I love my eBay buyers, I love my podcast listeners, mention this here podcast. If you see something you're interested in, send me a note via eBay system and say, hey, Joe, I heard you're offering 30% off fail sale. Get it? It's supposed to be a fall sale, but never mind. I will give you 30% off just because you're a listener. Now, this here podcast will drop, if I'm a judge of podcasts, on the 14th, correct, Mr. Strode?
Yes.
So I will give you through the 20th to, if you see anything you want, it's yours for 30% off. Just what you do is, like I said, go on to, I don't know, just pick one. And it says contact buyer. When you contact me, it'll come up that you contacted me through whatever item you're interested in, and I can return and offer you a 30% discount. That's how it's going to work. So, and it doesn't matter if you're overseas or not, because eBay has an eBay global shipping. They'll take care of the shipping. I don't even have to charge you. I have no idea what eBay charges, but that's, you know, I'm just telling you, this is for anybody as my way, because as you know, I regret the error. K-R-A-Y-Z. Come get some.
And now we get to my favorite part of the show. No, 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 not where I go mad with power and start marrying all the stray cats to each other in the neighborhood. Although that would be fun. No, it's Freaking and Geeking. Joe, what are you freaking on?
I know occasionally when I ship something, it doesn't get to where it's going via eBay. And usually I just give a refund, you know. I've always suspect, but I had three actually come back. Some bitch. I gotta get my Jackie Gleason going. Let me try that again. Some bitch actually broke into the postal box. I dropped three eBay orders. It was right before we went up north. I alluded to it last podcast. And, you know, we thought, hey, they're going to pick up tomorrow. I dropped the three things in there. About a week later, I got a package. And I love getting packages. We'll talk about it when we get to geeking, because I've been buying a lot of stuff off eBay and Amazon too. Well, I got this package. I lift it up. It's like really light. And I open it up. It's three packages. Actually, opened the packages and then took what was in them and left the shit in the mailbox. So when the post office on Monday picked up the thing, they're like, oh, shit. And they send me a letter. This stuff's been ripped off. We have no idea who did it. Blah, blah, blah. They didn't get away with much. Ironically, they got away with a Christian comic. So I hope the son of a bitch is reading it. And then they're, hey, you know what? God's got a top 10. And one of them is, thou shall not steal. But probably not, because I doubt the troglodyte was looking for comic books in the mail system. More often, he's probably looking for checks or something he thinks he could flip. Lord knows, I can't wait till he goes, hey, what are these worth? They're not worth shit. Good job, Dicklick. Makes me mad. So anyways, I just sent the note to the people involved. I said, I apologize. Here's the letter from the post office. I just gave the refund. Again, it doesn't happen much, and it's never happened before at this particular post office. I don't know what happened. Did they see me drop the thing and go, hey, let's go rip this off? Did they get anything else? Oh, well. I'm still in bid watch. As we speak, I have not bid on my new shift. I'm pretty sure I'm going to checkpoint after 18 years of working in bags. Again, if you've listened to this podcast, when I was on the road, I worked checkpoint, but it's just annoying. But by this, well, actually, we won't know by the next time we pod. But the week after, I'll be able to tell you what the hell happened. Actually, maybe before that. It depends on when we get together again to pod again, Corey. And I'll refer to it a little bit more when we get to geeking. That's called foreshadowing, folks. today, happy Labor Day for those of you off. I wasn't. I mean, we're recording this the day after Labor Day, but that's what happened was, is I had training I had to go to, and for some reason it actually happened on Labor Day, and there were more people in the office than I actually thought there would be. And we're all wearing masks and we're all social distancing. So there are only six of us and the instructor. It was another instructor coming in and out because she must have been doing one of the weird TSA tests that they spring on all of us, because she had to close the door and say, "We're testing in here. Don't be loud." And we're like, "Well, we hadn't planned on being loud, but now we gotta." What was weird about it is when you work a holiday. Okay, let's start this over. Basically, you get holiday pay if you work for the federal government. So 90% of the federal government had Labor Day off. Then there's people like me who, if I worked Labor Day, I get holiday pay. If not, I get the holiday pay goes back to the day I did work. So for me, that would have been Saturday. Knowing I was going in on Monday to actually punch in and work, I was kind of miffed a little bit, because if I had worked Saturday, I'd have gotten 10 hours of holiday pay. As it was, I got 5 hours, because that's how long the training was. Maybe six. I'll find out next week when I have something else to bitch about. So I got kind of gypped a little bit of holiday pay. Whatever. I've got a job. I'm very cognizant of that. It was just kind of one of those odd things. And we're recording this on a Tuesday. I got to get up early Wednesday. You know how well I get up Wednesday. If not, go back, listen to the end of August, beginning of September, when I got banished because I had a bad hip. And I had other things to complain about.
Banished.
I am not a morning guy. I mean, I have to get up by six. I got to get up. Fortunately, Labor Day was slow traffic, and I'm beating rush hour by about a half hour trying to get to where I'm going. So I'm pretty happy about that. Other than that, that's really it. I've been freaking. Things have been going pretty well. Corey, how about you? What are you freaking on?
I was watching the AEW All Out event.
AEW,
one of the matches.
AEW. Think that'll catch on?
Maybe.
Okay.
But one of the matches was Matt Hardy versus Sammy Guevara, a broken rules match, which was basically a no DQ match. You know, it's going to be plunder and destruction and fighting everywhere. And it's last man standing. So if you can't answer the 10 count, you lose. And Matt Hardy put in the stipulation that if he loses, he would leave AEW. Well, he hasn't even been there for 6 months, so you're pretty much guaranteed he's going to win. So in their first major spot, they go up on one of those scissor lifts. Sammy spears Matt, and what they're supposed to do is hit this merchandise table. And the table would kind of break their fall. However, they traveled too far with the spear, kind of hit and slid off the table, and the back of Matt's head hit the concrete.
Ooh.
And he was out. He was unconscious a good 45 seconds. Referee throws up the X. The doctor comes out. Matt starts to get up. There were a couple times Sammy came over and the referee would just make him go back. You know, this isn't storyline. He's really hurt. The announcers thought that there was blood under his head, but it was really the red hair. You know, he's dyed part of his hair red, so when he's laying there, the red hair actually looked like blood, but there was no blood. But he was out for a good 45 seconds. He got up and was, you could tell, he had no idea where he was. His eyes were completely glazed over. The doctor came, and as the doctor's coming, they ring the bell. And the announcers are like, the match is over. The match is over. The doctor's coming out to see if Matt's okay. The doctor looks at, you know, barely examines him. Then Matt goes over. He stumbles over to Sammy and grabs onto him as he's, you know, stumbling and falling. Pretty much takes off Sammy Guevara's trunk, so Sammy Guevara got pantsed, and we got to see his ass.
Hey now.
And Sammy leaves the area. The doctor examines him a little more, and then Matt Hardy follows him. They brawl a little bit on their way to the ring. Then they get up on the stage and they climb the scaffolding. They go about 10 to 15 feet up in the air. Matt starts punching Sammy. Sammy takes the planned bump where he falls, goes through the stage. He can't answer the count. Matt Hardy wins. What happened was, after the doctor had cleared him, they went ahead and went right to the finish. They should not have continued that match for any reason. You got a guy who's probably got a concussion. He was unconscious for nearly a minute. And you're going to have him climb 15 feet in the air to do a stunt. It was reckless. It really crushed a lot of my enjoyment of the pay-per-view. And I'm having to write this up. And it wasn't till after the match that, oh yeah, Matt was 100% injured. None of that was planned. Because as I wrote it, it's like, this really, they rushed to the ending. It doesn't seem planned. This doesn't seem, you know, it doesn't seem like storyline. And Mike Johnson, who works on the site, was like, no, Matt was legit hurt. That was a legit injury. Matt actually went to the hospital and was kept overnight. They should have ended the match and said, nope. A no contest. We'll finish the match later. The only other thing I am really freaking on is the fact that it went from 90 degrees to 50 degrees in a day. I was not ready for it to get to where you wake up and it's like, oh, it's too cold to take a shower.
It could be worse. It could be snowing in 33. Oh, I'm sorry. That's Denver, even as we record.
Well, it is 2020. So what? There was one of our conventions at the Thunderbird, which we always held the weekend after the
Renaissance. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Renaissance Fair. Yeah.
Yep. We always had it the weekend the Renaissance Fair closed. And there was one weekend where we did get snow. It didn't stick. But I remember we got snow and people were like, oh, my God, it's September. Why is it snowing in September? And I said, well, it's Minnesota. And then there was also, you know, the October convention about a decade later where it was like over 90 degrees.
SweatCon.
Yep. So I was not ready for it to get this cold. Not ready for having to turn on my heat already. I am kind of glad that I used some of the time over my vacation last week to do some weatherproofing on the house, but it's not like I'm going to be putting up the storm windows and everything. Joe, what are you geeking on?
I'll just make a quick freaking footnote that GalaxyCon, they canceled it as well. And they're kind of in a limbo because they haven't officially canceled it, because if the city of Minneapolis comes and tells them we're not allowing you to have the con, they are not liable. If they cancel it, then they're liable. And Minneapolis hasn't done that, even though the hotel has canceled all the rooms if you tried to get a room to this thing. And they have a big thing up saying, hey, we're kind of in a rock and a hard place. We're waiting for Minneapolis to I forget the name of the official term, to do that, where they say, no, you cannot do it. So
that's what happened with WrestleMania. Everybody was so mad that they hadn't canceled WrestleMania. And if Vince canceled WrestleMania, the insurance wouldn't have paid. When Florida canceled WrestleMania, insurance paid.
Yeah. So, but, you know, it's not going to happen. Corey, do you remember the scene in Avengers Endgame as the Avengers work to revive the blip caused by Thanos when Rocket and Hulk embarked to the new Asgard to recruit Thor, and they hitched a ride in the back of a Land Rover Defender 110 pickup truck as the two superheroes enjoyed the scenic views before coming back to reality and battling to make the world right again?
Probably.
I have the Hot Wheel of that.
Oh!
They created the highly detailed diecast version of the truck with real rider tires, which means rubber, and they got Rocket and Hulk in the back, and of course they made it so that the back is depressed a lot because of the weight of the Hulk. This was a San Diego Comic-Con giveaway that, because they couldn't do the giveaway, they actually did it online where you could go on and get two of them if you want. I couldn't because I was at work. So I paid some guy way back in July to get one. And he some guy on the eBays. But I did keep in touch with him and just say, hey, how's it looking? He said, hey, I appreciate you waiting. Because, you know, people get antsy. Oh, we're canceled if you can't ship it. I said, well, they're not shipping them until July 25th. Well, they shipped them last week. And, oh, does it look cool. It's like the Thanos copter. It came sealed. But unlike the Thanos copter, I cut the tape on the box. And you can slide it out because it's in a nice display window. So you can actually get a good view of everything. So that was kind of fun. I kind of enjoyed coming home to that. I mentioned geeking. I took Saturday off. And I was just, oh, my gosh, I was lazy. My goal was, okay, I'm off Saturday. I can go here. I can go there. But I'm geeking in a couple weeks. So I sat and I fell down the Disney Plus National Geographic channel. And I started off by watching Back to the Titanic, which is interesting because they went down after 15 years. I forget who owns the rights to the Titanic now. It's they got a museum in Vegas, RMS Titanic Unlimited or whatever. They have the salvage rights. And that's where they had all the controversy, because what they did is they went through the debris field, not the Titanic itself, but the debris field, and brought stuff up and they put it on museums. I believe they auctioned some of it to keep the funds going. Anyways, they went back down to look at it. It hasn't been 15 years. Corey, what do you think's happened in 15 years?
Let's see. In 15 years, I will still be working two jobs.
I'm talking from 15 years ago to now.
Oh,
same thing. You're still working two jobs.
Yeah.
No, basically there's bacteria that were on the Titanic. What's the term? Anaerobic? No.
Yes, anaerobic is without oxygen.
And they are forming rusticles. They're basically eating the ship away.
Yes, I have heard about that.
The proof in the pudding is when they were there 15 years ago, they actually were able to get shots of the captain's cabin because it had been sheared away and there was the bathtub. You know, he got full ivory bathtub, porcelain, whatever it was back then. Now it's fallen in the deck and they got just little pieces of it. So basically this thing's going to disappear. There are pretty much no bodies left because they've since been eaten away. And of course the big question is what to do with it. They cannot save it. It is going to disappear. Do they let it disappear? Or do they go in, dig up that stern to figure out what happened? Or not the stern, the bow. Or do they just leave it as a gravesite? I'm going to ask you that question again, Corey, in a bit. But it was called Back to the Titanic. Fascinating. After that, if you like that, you should watch this. I ran into a series called Drain the Ocean. I don't know if you've ever seen these, Corey. What they do... In this case, it was Drain the Ocean to Reveal the Titanic. It's a fun series. What they do is they go down and they do – it might either have been the same or different. I kind of got the feeling it was maybe a different – maybe it was 15 years ago when they do super side scans and sonar and things like that. And they build themselves a 3D model and then they – if we could drain the ocean of trillions of tons and let the Titanic see the light of day – and then they talk about what they find. What's annoying about it is that this was obviously made for, I believe, the Discovery Channel. So every 15 minutes there or whatever, there's like a break in the action, and then they come back. If you could drain the Titanic and give, you know, so they kind of revamp, recap, and you're like, I just watched this. So it's not like Nova on PBS where it's 1 hour of television. It's 45 minutes, and it's, you know, a lot of recap. What they did find out in the Titanic were a couple things. First of all, they discovered with this new 3D technique that they did that there are little gashes along the side where the iceberg was. Because the confusion is they thought, oh, the big 300-foot gash. But it took 2.5 hours for the Titanic to sink. 300-foot gash would take approximately 2 minutes to sink, not 2.5 hours. So there was no huge gash like everybody thought. Now, you've seen the movie Titanic, Corey?
Oh, yeah.
You know how the bow breaks away and the stern floats a little bit and then goes down?
Yes, which at the time was new information.
Well, they didn't. I think it was Molly Brown, the unthinkable Molly Brown. She said a lot of people said they saw it. No one believed them.
Right.
But what happened is they're saying there's something that's not right. The size of the debris field indicates that the Titanic did not break up on the surface, because if it did, the debris field would be a lot larger than it is. Their hypothesis is that, yeah, it may have broke like that, but the Titanic broke in half underwater, maybe 1,000 feet or more down, because the debris field doesn't, it would be humongous. It would be tens of, if not hundreds of miles wide, breaking 3.5 miles up on the surface and going down. So they're thinking it probably went down a lot farther before it finally broke in half. Now, you've seen the tail end of the Titanic.
Yes.
You know how it looks?
Yeah.
And what they're figuring is the other thing that happened is the bow of the Titanic filled with water sunk, and that's why it went gracefully down. However, when a ship sinks, it's full of bubbles, and that's what caused the stern to look like somebody just crushed it with a giant hand. All those bubbles went in and just imploded and exploded, and that's why the stern looks so utterly destroyed, and the bow, which I believe what they say is a mile or so from, is just gracefully sunk. Go forward to the World War. They're going to drain the ocean for World War II secrets. Corey, you know the mighty battleship Bismarck?
Yes.
Was it scuttled or did it sink because of the British bombings?
That's always been a mystery.
Maybe not. Remember what I said about the Titanic. If it was sunk, it would go down, that air bubbles would destroy the ship. The Bismarck is largely intact on the bottom of the ocean. It's remarkably well kept for a boat that allegedly was shot and sunk. Now, it's full of holes. That's for damn sure. I mean, this thing looks like Swiss cheese when they showed a 3D model. But it, what they're thinking is that the Germans, knowing it was going down, had to have scuttled it in order for it to get onto the bottom of the ocean in such a great, well, intact shape. Otherwise, those air bubbles would have totally destroyed it like we've seen in the Titanic. Corey, have you ever heard of the USS Independence aircraft carrier?
Yes.
You know what happened to it?
I do not.
Well, after World War II...
But they're going to drain the ocean to tell us.
They're damn straight, because these are the lost nukes of World War II. And I discovered two things I didn't know about. First of all, you've heard about the B-52 bomb explosion over Spain.
Yes.
And I think it was 65, and one nuke did not detonate, but it exploded. And there's a mile and a half square area of Spain that's still contaminated by plutonium. One of the nukes disappeared when underwater, and they only found it years later. And by draining the ocean, well, the first time they went for it, it was sitting on a cliff, and then it sunk into the Mediterranean, because draining that Mediterranean was tough. Now, instead of being under 1,000 feet of water, it's under like 2,000 feet of water. Well, they sent the submersive down to pick it up. As it got down there, it got hung up in the parachute. So now they're pulling a live nuke up. They're pulling the submersible up by the parachute. And the parachute's holding the 2-ton nuke as it's going up. And if it breaks, well, they didn't know if that thing was armed or not. I'll save you the sweats, because I know you are. It's stored in Nevada right now, because out of the two nukes that did not explode, they were able to recover them. To this day, there's still nuclear fission material there. The Independence, after World War II, they blew it up at Bikini Atoll. But the question is how did it end up 40 miles off Montego Bay, which is like 30 miles south of San Francisco, if it allegedly was sunk in Bikini Atoll? What they figured out is because we didn't know a lot about radioactivity then, is they pulled it into San Francisco at a top secret naval base just on the outskirts of San Francisco, studied it a number of years, filled it up with nuclear waste material, and then sunk it. Although they said it was sunk 100 miles offshore, they actually, it was 40 miles offshore. So if you're bored and want to go check it out. Now, the question I had, Corey, you know what else they drained? They drained all sorts of stuff. And I'm only halfway through. They drained Alcatraz. They drained the Great Lakes. And I was going to go on and on about Alcatraz, but the question I want to talk about on the Great Lakes, you know, everybody knows the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Yes.
So, most of the Great Lakes.
Tell us about the TV show.
They drained the lakes, and a lot of it's geographic stuff, like they didn't know. Like, have you seen the, there's a site in Arizona where a meteorite hit and created a crater that's still there?
Yes.
They think they have similar crater in one of the Great Lakes because they have a big asshole that's circular and they can't quite figure out what it is. And by draining the lake, they figured out what it was. Now they drained, of course, and they mentioned all the shipwrecks they could find, some remarkably intact. And of course, the Edmund Fitzgerald is there 500 feet in water. Now, what's the, Gordon Lightfoot's song, he says, Superior, it's said, never gives up its dead. Because the water is so cold, bodies do not decompose and rise to the surface. Those 29 men who died in the Edmund Fitzgerald, their body is still entombed in the wreck. The question, now this is a gravesite. They are not going to go, I mean, they might go down and check it out every so often, make sure it's okay. But they basically, they lifted the bell, they put it in the Great Shipwreck Museum at Whitefish Point, and they put a replacement bell, and they're never going down there again because it is a gravesite. The question I have for you, Corey, back to the Titanic, gravesite, do not touch it, or should we salvage as much as we can so we can keep a memory alive of it? Not that we're ever going to forget. What do you think?
My opinion is that it's a gravesite. We've done enough digging around in it. We've done computer mapping. We've done all this scientific stuff. We've actually been bringing stuff up from the bottom. It feels, even though it was 100 years ago, it still feels like grave robbing to me. Let nature take its course.
I'm kind of torn between that because it's going to go. I don't think you need to mess with the stern, mess with the bow. I don't have any problem with the debris field. And they've actually returned things that they've discovered who it was. They've actually gotten some closure for some people because they've, you know, here's a pocket watch of, you know, your great grandfather who went down or your husband who went down. That was probably when the Titanic exhibit was touring back in, I think it was the 80s, wasn't it? And they, that was the thing that really hit me, is this is a pocket watch that they know who it belonged to, and they gave it to the widow. And then when the widow passed away, she gave it back to the people who exhibited. So I think I'm on board with you on that one. Next week, I'll explain to you what happened to the three guys who escaped Alcatraz and were never heard from again. No, you want to go see it? Check it out. Drain the ocean. I mean, it's corny. Hey, we're going to drain the ocean for the first time, but it's just fascinating. And my wife and I watched the Alcatraz one because she liked it. Lest you think I spent all Saturday watching that, I did catch Surviving Mount St. Helens, where they talk to people who survived Mount St. Helens, and Miracle Landing on the Hudson, same thing, where they talk to people who were involved with that. So that was kind of And, you know, lest you think Corey's escaped, I'm going to be – we're geeking this weekend. Yes, finally we'll have all the free comic book day stuff together, courtesy of Granite City Comics. So we're going to use my wife's brand-new car, and why? God bless her. She's letting us use it. We're gonna wake up Birch, probably be showering when he is, and we're going to head north. And we got a whole – look, in my greasy hands – I got a ton of little things here, places we're going to stop, and we'll talk about it in some future episode. Yeah, I had a lot of time on Saturday. Corey, what you geeking on?
I had a lot of time last week. I had last week off.
Cool.
And I planned to do very little. I planned to take care of some stuff in the house that needed to be taken care of, and I did so. I planned to read comics, and I did so. I planned to watch a lot of TV, and I did. I subscribed to Curiosity Stream, which is an online service that has science and educational documentaries from around the world. And I'm the only person that probably would go, what'd you do on your vacation? I watched a 4-hour documentary on the history and creation of money. Where did money come from? How did we decide to quit trading goods and services in a barter system for something that represented those things? What was the first stock market? Joe, do you know where the first stock market was?
I want to say ancient Greece.
Nope.
Nope.
Amsterdam. And it was merchants who had who were sailing to the Far East around the south of Africa. They would sell shares in the trips to finance the trips. And one of the more interesting figures, and it's funny how I watched that documentary and they had a, you know, like about a half hour on the guy. And then I'm listening to NPR's Morning Edition and they had a short documentary on the guy, John Law, the first guy who created the French stock market and drove France into the ground and probably caused the French Revolution.
How you know?
He was a total scam artist. Comic-wise, I am getting all caught up on the Dawn of X books. Not only do I love Jonathan Hickman stuff, but this format is fantastic because it puts them all in chronological order, and it's easy to tell that Hickman has said, okay, here are the plot threads that will come out of here. If you want to grab them, go ahead. If you want to grab them, go ahead, but this is where we're going. Because even the stuff that he doesn't write flows out of the stuff that he's doing in X-Men and New Mutants and then flows back in. And if you're going to have a line of books that's interconnected, this is how it should be. And these books that reprint 6 issues each, putting them in chronological order, it's just so much nicer than buying regular comics. And, well, these 4 books came out this week. What order are they in? Or, you know, this book came out. Where should I read it? Just a fantastic way to package these comics, and I really hope it continues. I hold in my hand an omnibus that I am about 3/4 through.
And liar! Can't hold an omnibus in a single hand. Who are you fooling?
Yes, I can.
I won't mess with you.
It is Morbius the Living Vampire, and I believe that this one is only like yeah, it's only like 850 pages, so it can be held in one hand. But it starts with the first appearance, of course, in Amazing Spider-Man 101, which was the, after Spider-Man 100. Joe, what was the cliffhanger at the end of Spider-Man 100?
What did the thief, oh wait, after or before?
Spider-Man 100. What was 100. The thing on the last page?
Didn't he, I'm Spider-Man no more.
No, it's when he grew 4 more arms.
Oh, good grief. I'm sorry, there's some things I just blot from my memory.
And it's funny because when you pick it up, it's like, you know, Stan Lee editor, Roy Thomas writer. It's like Stan gave him that cliffhanger and went, I'm on vacation. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
But it's got the Marvel team-up stories. It's got the stories from the Black and White magazine. And I'll tell you what, the stories from the Black and White magazines, head and shoulders above the stuff in the Adventure into Fear color comic that they were doing for Morbius the Living Vampire. It's just fun stuff. Even the stories that aren't that great are fun because they're 70s. And the 70s Spider-Man is just, there's something a little grittier about it when he's always on the run from the cops. And it's weird how Spider-Man during the 70s was considered an outlaw, and he had to hide from the cops because they were always trying to arrest him. And that just continued forever. And it started with the death of Captain Stacy, if I remember right. And then it got even worse when the Green Goblin died. Let's see. In the next book that I have that I've been reading is Legends of the Dark Knight, Matt Wagner, which is all but two of Matt Wagner's Batman stories. No, wait, all but three of Matt Wagner's Batman stories. It's got the Faces story, which was his Two-Face story, the Riddle Factory, which was his Riddler one-shot, then the two miniseries, Batman the Monster Man and Batman the Mad Monk. It's also got the one-shot story he did in Tom King's run of Batman and the story he did for Batman Black and White. But now that I've given Joe kind of a hint, does Joe know, for a shiny new dime, what are the three Matt Wagner stories about Batman that cannot be in this book?
Grendel, Batman. Batman Shadow. And I can't think of the third one.
Batman Grendel. There was Grendel Batman, and then Batman Grendel.
Oh, okay. I'm like counting that as one.
Yeah, kind of like they did with the Spawn thing, where there was Spawn Batman and then Batman Spawn. And the last thing on my list of stuff that I read was, move those books aside because they're very heavy. I have to pull up the title. What it is, it's a reprint of the stories from the last version of Marvel Comics Presents, which was an anthology book. It lasted, 12 issues, and it did stories set in each decade. It was a 80th anniversary celebration book, so they had a story set in the 40s, a story set in the 50s, a story set in the 60s. But I want to get the name of the book. Hold on, I'm pulling it up here because I read it digitally.
Whoa, he's whipping it out.
Tales Through the Marvel Universe. It is a trade paperback. I bought it digitally because it was one of those where they had it, you know, for steep discounts. So it's, I'll pick that up. It reprints the stories from the Marvel Comics Presents, the ones going through the decades. And the thing that I liked best about it was that they didn't care about continuity so much. It was more, okay, we're in the 60s. Here's a Spider-Man story from when, you know, in the style of when Spider-Man was being printed in the 60s. The Nightcrawler story was for the 80s, and it was set during the fall of the Berlin Wall and when he was in Excalibur. You've got a Mark Waid story in there. You've got stories by other people. But it's just such a cool thing and shows that really good writers can do a great story in 12 to 14 pages, which is something we don't get a lot of anymore. Which, you know, it's one of the reasons why I always say I like anthologies, because I like short stories. I think short stories are a form that doesn't get used a lot. And that is my list of the stuff I am geeking on. Believe it or not, kids, you've listened to us blather on about funny books for an hour and a half.
Hot snot, good for you. Why don't you rewind it and then listen to it again? 4 hours.
Or go back and start with episode one and move forward.
Hey, somebody did that. And if he sends me a note, I'll put him on the list for the Joe prizes if we can ever find the box they're in.
And I believe that Butch is doing that too.
The Butch prize?
Well, Butch could give himself a prize.
Yeah, he deserves it.
And as I said at the wedding, go do that voodoo that you do so well. But as I say for the podcast, the comic we like the least, we still like better than the comic that you like the most. Joe?
Did you hear the rumor about the butter? Well, I'm not going to spread it.
Oh, God.
I live for that noise. Hit my music.
Done, bitches!